The action which was announced last Friday by the representative of the government of Israel touching the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Aqaba and Gaza is still in doubt, due entirely to the lack of clarity of the statement which was made last Friday in the Assembly of the United Nations by the representative of the government of the United States. Following up the statement of the Israeli government. Whether that lack of clarity was accidental or deliberate, I am not in position to say, but clearly it was of a nature calculated to shake the confidence of the people and of the government of Israel in the intention of the United States government, and has caused what I hope will be a temporary crisis and a delay. There have been those who said that the declaration made by the government of Israel announcing the withdrawal of its forces will prove a turning point in the affairs of the Near East. That may be. But everything will depend on how the events of a few days ago are followed up. Because nothing really was finally settled last Friday. No basic issue which has agitated the Near East for the last 8 years has been resolved, not a single one. The Suez-Sinai action of last October, November, in which Great Britain and France and Israel participated, which failed of its major objectives, thanks to the determined intervention of the United States, which was itself not entirely blameless for the conditions in the Near East, which made that action almost inevitable. I say that this Suez-Sinai action came to a close. We hope came to a close with the announcement last Friday that the Israeli forces are withdrawing behind the armistice line. But the liquidation of that military action leaves the situation in that part of the world practically where it was prior to last October and November. The final disposition of the Suez Canal, which is now being cleared, remains completely unsettled. Colonel Nasser indicated a few days ago that the 6 points, which were to serve as a basis of agreement between himself and the maritime powers using the Suez Canal, that these 6 points have been, to use his terms, washed out and no longer binding upon him. Colonel Nasser now feels himself to be the master of the canal by virtue of his power to sink ships and block the passage of oil to the Western world And he has gained two powerful allies. One is the Soviet Union, and the other, not consciously so, but actually so, America's resolve to woo and placate the Arabs at all costs in order to protect the vast interests of American oil companies in that part of the world. So that the issue of the Suez is far from being settled, and the final disposition of Aqaba and Gaza is likewise unclear. On the face of it, Israel has scored a victory in that the United States, not the United Nations, mind you, the United States stated that the Aqaba Gulf comprehends international waters and that no nation has a right to prevent free and innocent passage in the Gulf and through the state which give access to it, and that the United States is prepared to exercise the right of free passage and to join with others to secure general recognition of this right. That seems to be a definite gain for Israel, in that it acknowledges what Israel has maintained right along, its right to free and innocent passage through Aqaba for its own shipping and for world shipping. The representative of the government of Israel, Prime Minister Golda Meir, supplemented this position of the United States last Friday by declaring that the government of Israel has learned with gratification that other leading maritime powers are prepared to subscribe to this doctrine and have a similar intention to exercise their rights of free passage in the Gulf and through the Strait. It is intended that the UN Emergency Force should move in at Sharm el-Sheikh as soon as Israeli forces withdraw. But no guarantee is given as to how long these forces will stay there. All that seems to be agreed is that the Secretary General of the United Nations would inform the Advisory Committee of the UN Emergency Force, which would then determine whether the matter should be brought to the attention of the Assembly. Whether this covers up a real guarantee that no precipitate action will be taken to bring in Egyptian forces as soon as the UN forces are withdrawn, or whether they will stay there until a permanent peace settlement is achieved, it is not very clear. According to Golda Meir, this procedure will give the General Assembly the opportunity to ensure that no precipitate changes would be made which would have the effect of increasing the possibility of belligerent acts. She has reason to believe that in such a discussion, many members of the United Nations would be in favor of maintaining the UN force in the Straits of Tiran until peaceful conditions were in practice assured. Well, that may be so, and we hope that it will be so. And if our State Department does not later on, under the press of other matters, choose to ignore these commitments, which are in fact no legal commitments at all, if that does not happen, this expectation of Golda Meir may be so, may come true. And if it will prove to be so, then indeed Israel has scored an important victory. For free passage through Aqaba, for Israeli and Israeli-bound shipping, will prove an inestimable economic boon to the young state. It will open doors upon the Indian Ocean. It will open doors to profitable trade with the Far East and with South Africa, and may in time even come to channel a considerable part of the oil now shipped to Western Europe, now passing through the Suez, through its own Israeli pipelines, which, by the way, are now in the process of construction. But in this connection, it should be well to recall the statement which the foreign minister of Egypt and Egypt's representative at the UN made last Friday, following these statements of Israel and the United States and France. Dr. Mahmoud Fawzi declared, "The assembly has heard the statement made by the representative of Israel and several other statements relating to Israel's withdrawal. We take it that the assembly is unanimous in expecting full and honest implementation of its resolution calling for immediate and unconditional withdrawal by Israel. This position, which is the only position the assembly could possibly take, remains intact and entire. Nothing said by anyone here or elsewhere could shake this fact or detract from its reality and its validity, nor could it affect the fullness and the lawfulness of Egypt's rights and those of the Arab people of the Gaza Strip." It is clear, therefore, that Egypt is not prepared to accept this position of Israel, of the United States, other governments. And this means that the problem is far from being settled. And what is said about Aqaba may be applied with equal or even greater force to Gaza. Israel has indicated that it is ready to withdraw its military and civil forces, civil administrative forces, completely from Gaza. But its withdrawal is based on certain assumptions. The word condition is not used, but there is no doubt that definite reservations are implied. And these assumptions are that the takeover will be entirely by UN forces, both military and civilian. And until there is a permanent peace settlement or a definitive agreement on the future of the Gaza Strip, those UN forces will stay in Gaza. Now, the Egyptian forces will not return to Gaza. And if conditions will indicate a return to the conditions of deterioration which existed previously, Israel reserves its freedom to act to defend its rights. Now, the United States position, as stated by Henry Cabot Lodge, does not fully meet the position of Israel. I repeat again, whether that was purely a matter of accident or deliberate, I do not know. But I'm sure that the government of the United States must have seen the document of Golda Meir before it was read to the assembly. And therefore it is surprising that Ambassador Lodge's statement did not fully meet the position of the government of Israel. For the most part, he maintained Israel's declaration constitute restatements of what has already been said by the Assembly or by Secretary General, or they are hopes and expectations which seem to us not unreasonable in the light of the prior actions of the Assembly. And that is a frightful understatement of the situation. What was called for is not only a declaration that these assumptions are reasonable, but the United States government approves of them, just as the French spokesman stated at the Assembly. And then he proceeded that from a juridical standpoint, the future of the Gaza Strip must be worked out within the framework of the armistice agreement. The position of the government of Israel is that Egypt has so constantly violated the armistice agreement during the last 8 years that it is no longer a valid agreement. But the United States, continued Mr. Lodge, entertains the hope that the role the United Nations and its subsidiary bodies could usefully continue until there is a definitive settlement respecting the Gaza Strip. This sounds, to a layman, I am not an international lawyer, but this sounds to a layman as if someone were talking from both sides of his mouth, and that usually ends up in spluttering. There is no definite assurance here that the Egyptians will not return to Gaza, and no indication as to how long the transition period is to last. Evidently, the reaction in Israel to this declaration of the U.S. government has been very negative, and it has made the position of Ben-Gurion, who has been striving awfully hard to settle this issue in a just and amicable way and to make one concession after another in order to meet the position of the United Nations. It has made the position of Ben-Gurion very difficult in his own country. And I imagine that is why the President of the United States yesterday sent a reassuring letter to Mr. Ben-Gurion, clarifying what should have been very clear in the statement of Senator Lodge, and suggesting to the government of Israel that they will not lose by going along. The United States government will, I'm not quoting him exactly because I have not seen the exact text, the United States government will stand by and defend Israel's legitimate rights, both at Aqaba and in Gaza. I understand, too, that another letter covering about the same ground has been sent to the Prime Minister of Israel. Well, the situation at the moment is beclouded and foggy, but I am hoping that it will clear up. And much will depend upon the honorable intentions behind these statements and undertakings. If in the future, as in the past, unfortunately, formalism and legal dialectics will be resorted to in an attempt to nullify these commitments, which are not legal commitments, but moral commitments, or to whittle them down, seriously to modify them, then the situation will again become seriously aggravated. A week or two ago, when the President of the United States made his radio address on the Middle East situation, I commented upon it in the public press, you may recall, and among other things, I stated The citizens of Israel have great confidence in the moral integrity and the goodwill of President Eisenhower. This will weigh heavily in the scale as their government considers and makes its final decision on this latest appeal of the President of the United States. And I find the very same thought expressed last Friday by Goldie Mayer. She quotes the declaration of President Eisenhower, "We shall not assume that if Israel withdraws, Egypt will prevent Israeli shipping from using the Suez Canal or the Gulf of Aqaba." And Mrs. Golda Meir adds, "This declaration has weighed heavily with my government in determining its action today." When it's all boiled down, it is a case of confidence in the last analysis, a confidence to which Israel still clings, I might say, in spite of repeated disillusionments. And we hope that this confidence will not again be betrayed. There are grave and solemn obligations assumed by the government of the United States, by the President of the United States. In calling upon Israel to abandon powerful positions which it holds, for the sake of a general pacification, in so doing, our government has assumed tremendous obligation towards Israel to see that its legitimate rights are not in the future ignored or sacrificed to serve other interests. It is a matter of confidence and a matter of general morality. And I was pleased that the representative of the government of Israel, after she had presented in clear, concise, and convincing argument the position and the decision of Israel, she followed it up by an appeal, a moral appeal. "Can we," she said, turning to the Arab delegations representing the Arab world in the United Nations Assembly, "can we from now on, all of us, turn a new leaf? And instead of fighting with each other, can we all, united, fight poverty and disease and illiteracy? Is it possible for us to put all our efforts and all our energy into one single purpose, the betterment and progress and development of all of our lands and all of our peoples? I can here pledge the government and the people of Israel to do their part in this united effort. There is no limit to what we are prepared to contribute, so that all of us together can live to see a day of happiness for our peoples and see again from that region a great contribution to peace and happiness for all humanity." These are memorable words spoken with statesmanship. If this spirit prevails, then indeed a new climate will have been created for the settlement of all the issues in the Near East. For there isn't a single issue in that part of the world which cannot be settled given goodwill and a desire for constructive solutions which will redound to the benefit of all. Israel has again made a contribution to peace in the announcement of last Friday. It did not have to withdraw. The threat of sanctions was a hollow threat. The United Nations could not have imposed it, had no authority to impose it. The Security Council never would have imposed it, because there was a veto there against sanctions. The resentment of the free world, the sentiments of the free world, revolted against the idea of the imposition of sanctions on Israel. And in my humble judgment, it was a tragic mistake for our government to suggest that it would go along with it. Our government knew full well that the Assembly of the United Nations would vote no sanctions unless the United States gave it the go-sign. And the United States was not prepared to give it the go-sign, because the American people were violently opposed to sanctions against Israel. The leaders of the administration's own party were opposed to it. The free governments of the world were opposed to it. The very peoples who were suffering most from the closing of the Suez Canal by Nasser, Great Britain and France, were opposed to sanctions. Why then was that miserable threat held over Israel? But it was not held over India or Hungary or Russia or Egypt. I haven't the answer. Perhaps Aramco has. Why were the leaders of American Jewish community selected leaders of the American Jewish community, heads of our fundraising agencies, summoned to Washington, not to be pressured, of course, Chas v'cholila, just for a friendly briefing, an exchange of views, no intimidation. But why were they called in the first place? I'm under the impression that was an act of a government, of a State Department, which was in panic and desperate. It was not an intelligent act. Why had our government maneuvered itself in recent years into such a desperate position? Sanctions against Israel, the one free democratic country in that part of the world which asks for nothing but the right to continue to live. Sanctions for Israel, but weapons, millions of dollars for King Saud of Arabia, despot of an oppressed and exploited and miserable people, who is pledged to destroy Israel, and who's allied with Nasser for that destruction, and whose country will not permit to this day Jewish personnel in the American air base at Daran. Why is this anomalous, this incomprehensible situation? Why has it come to be? I haven't the answer. Perhaps Aramco has, and the oil lobby. American oil diplomacy in the Near East has run afoul of Israel's resolve to survive as a nation. A And in one blind moment, our State Department was prepared to commit itself to the economic and therefore the political destruction of Israel by suggesting sanctions. And all this not to serve the cause of the authority and the prestige of the United Nations. All this is sanctimonious balderdash. When it serves the interest of the United States to ignore the UN, it has done so in the past time and again. And even in the early dispute about the Suez, it went about making its own arrangements. What has taken place, in my judgment, has been a tragic blunder. It is an act of unspeakable folly, which fortunately the American public opinion violently opposed, as well as the free world generally. It is to be hoped that similar acts of folly will not be committed in the future. Of course, no one in his right senses approves of a doctrine of solving international disputes by force. And no one for a moment would want to see the authority and the prestige of the United Nations lessened, diminished by an iota. But if a nation is subjected continuously to provocations and attacks by force on the part of neighbors who are committed to its destruction, and if that nation cannot receive protection from a world organization or from any of its powerful members who are pledged to the doctrine of not solving international disputes by force, what is such a nation to do except resort to self-defense by the use of force? Did the United Nations and the United States know of Egypt's building up of vast arms arsenals against Israel? They did. Did they do anything about it? They did not. Did Israel ask the United States for arms to protect itself against this massive armament of Egypt? It did. Did the United States grant these arms or permitted Israel to purchase these arms in the United States? It did not. Was the United States government supplying arms to the Arab states at the very time when it was refusing to sell arms to Israel? It did. Was the United Nations and the United States aware of the blockade against Israeli shipping in the Suez for years? They were. Did they do anything about it? They did not. Their resolution was passed in the Security Council and passed again, but that was the end of the matter. Did the United Nations and the United States know that Israeli shipping were not permitted to pass through the straits into Aqaba? They did. Did they do anything about it? Nothing. Was the United Nations aware of these military alliances which were forged all around Israel by its neighbors? Everybody in the world knew about them. Did they do anything about it? Nothing. Was the United Nations or the United States aware that in the last 8 years there were boycotts and blockades against Israel and numerous murders committed down the frontiers of Israel? Were they aware that ships which touch Israeli ports bringing necessary merchandise to Israel are not permitted then to visit any ports of any Arab country? A veritable blacklist in force? They have been aware of it. Did they do anything about it? Nothing. Well, now we ask, is this event of last Friday to mark a turning point? We hope so. Will greater efforts be made now, as the President has indicated, acknowledging that insufficient efforts or no efforts were made in the past? Will they now be made to safeguard justice and international law for the small as well as for the great? We hope so. Israel, I believe, will withdraw its forces. After the clarification, which I hope will be made, Israel has gained in the esteem of mankind. Israel has brought its case dramatically to the attention and to the conscience of the world in the last few months. I believe that its rights in the future will not be able to be stifled by world indifference in the future as they have been in the past. Israel emerges stronger from the events of the last 6 months. It has shown a capacity in the first place to fight for its rights. In 4 days, it smashed in one of the most brilliant campaigns of modern times the armed forces of Egypt. And did it so effectively that all the Arab neighbors who were pledged to come to the aid of any Arab country attack did not make a single move against Israel. Israel has shown a capacity to stand firmly for its rights, but it has shown also a capacity for statesmanship, for necessary compromise, which is evidence of political maturity and wisdom. It makes us all proud of the way they have conducted their affairs, military and political. Well, the hard days are still ahead after the withdrawal of the forces. There is still the matter of negotiating a peace settlement between Israel and the Arab nations. Israel has been asking for it from the very day that the armistice was signed 8 years ago. The Arab states have refused it, refusing to acknowledge the very existence of Israel. Except, of course, when the Israeli army smashed them in the Sinai Peninsula, and they couldn't help it, but acknowledged that Israel was there. These negotiations, which will have to take place sooner or later, we hope sooner than later, will have the prospect of success only if the authority of the great American people and government are thrown into the balance on the side of justice and fair play. If our foreign policy will not be dictated exclusively by the oil interests of some of our oil companies. I believe that America will rise to the challenge of a great opportunity to bring peace and prosperity to one of the most important and critical areas of the globe today. There has been much blundering and misguided thinking in the councils of our government. But there is also among some of the leaders of our country insight and understanding and a desire to see that justice is done to all concerned. I hope that the American public opinion will continue to guide the ultimate decisions of their leaders on this most important issue in the world at this moment. We pray for the continued well-being and peace of the young state of Israel. We pray for peace in that entire area. We pray for the spirit of wisdom and counsel to dominate the actions of our own government.